DCT Audio. The art of good listening.
You're listening to a podcast on the Audio Boom Network. This is A Mindful Life with me, Dave Thomas. Thank you for downloading this edition of the program. I do hope you enjoy it.
Well, I'm delighted to say I'm with two good friends, John and Arlene Chart. Both have a remarkable story, I suppose. John, let's start with you. You have motor neuron disease, and I think you've been living with that condition now for 8 years, which in itself is remarkable. You're one of the few that have. Basically, it's a terminal illness, but most people die within 2 years, I believe, of that condition. Before we talk about that, just tell me about your life before you had that diagnosis, I suppose.
Yeah, obviously grew up in southeast London, done well at school, got all my exams and whatever. When I left school, I decided to join the bank because I was told that was a great career. Joined the bank, worked for NatWest Bank for just short of 5 years, absolutely despised it, if I'm being honest with you, Dave. Felt like I was just wasted in the bank. So I applied to, I joined the Territorial Army and I was in the London Irish Rifles and 10 Para. And then I decided to go for the fire brigade. So, you know, always wanted to be a fireman. It'll be a dream of mine. Realised I wasn't too short because there was a 5'6" height limit, believe it or not, in the brigade back then. It's changed now. Realised I was an inch and a half over. So, right touch. So anyway, applied with two of my best mates, managed to get in and never looked back, really. I spent the rest of my career as a firefighter and I think I was pretty decent at it, I'd say. Yeah. The bits that I needed to be decent at anyway. And that was the rest of my career in the brigade.
But whilst you were in the fire brigade, you were also, I think you were a world champion powerlifter, is that right?
Yeah. So I was a world champion powerlifter. I was the world's strongest fireman for a few years. Always dabbled in sport here and there. So, I like to do a bit of running, a bit of fitness, and my dad was a weightlifter, not competitive. He was, like an amateur sort of hobbyist bodybuilder and weightlifter. And one of my older brothers one of the lads said one day in the gym, you're a strong boy, why don't you do something with it? You're very strong for your size. And it went from there, really, yeah. Done a few competitions and loved it.
Now, Arlene, you're John's partner. How did you get together? I suspect there might be a story here.
I've known the Chart family over 25 years. Cameron's 25, so about over 25 years I've known. So my ex-husband and John's sister Cheryl, they started working together on the buses many moons ago, and that's how we became friends. And I've always known John, his dad and his sisters. And his mum, I've been away with his mum and Cheryl many a times. I think, and then through the years, life continues and everything. And a couple of years, about 5 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, John and I got in contact again. And I think the rest is history now. Yeah, married, 4 years now?
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. A lot's happened.
And I say wow because, yeah, exactly, a lot has happened. And you've probably had a lifetime of experiences within those short 4 years. Going back to your motor neuron disease then, what were the first sort of things that you started to notice? You think something's not quite right here?
Yeah, so the first symptoms, beginning of 2016, my right bicep and tricep were just twitching. I just noticed them one day twitching in the light and looked down at them and thought, a bit odd, a bit weird, a bit of a twitch there, wonder what that is. And I probably didn't do anything about it that day or maybe even that week, but then obviously I noticed it again. Anyway, went to see the doctor. She said it's probably anxiety, probably a bit of... So gave me beta blockers, propranolol, took those. They didn't do anything. Went back there a number of 2-3 months later and said, oh, yeah, they didn't really do anything. And then they refer you to neurology then, when they can't really see what's going on. Twitching seems to be a neurological symptom. no matter what the illness is you have, twitching is a sign of a neurological problem. So they done that, and then 3 years, 5 months later, after several tests and several pleading emails from me saying, please, can you do this operation? Because they told me I had compressed nerves in my neck from powerlifting. I started getting a bit desperate because nothing was really happening. My arm was weakening and wasting away. And so a few desperate emails later, they said, right, you know, come in and see us. So I went in, and then she said, basically, look, where we've done these last tests, the EMG tests, we think your nervous system's getting attacked. It's not your neck. And that was it. In 10 seconds, your life changes from being all right to, no, you're going to die. You know, and then when she hit me with, like, well, yeah, we think you've got motor neuron disease, it's like shock horror. I welled up instantly. You know, I mean, it was shocking. It was shocking, to be honest. It was shocking.
Ollie, what do you, and I know I've spoken with you previously, John, about that day. But I'd really love to hear from you, Arlene, about your recollections of that day, from your perspective.
The day he was told he may have.
Yeah.
That morning, so I have rheumatoid arthritis, and I have to have monthly infusions. And John's appointment day fell on a day when I had to have my infusion. And I said to him, I'll go and have my infusion, and I'll come and pick you up. And he's like, no, it'll be fine. I'll get the bus there and I'll get the bus back. And you know when you just think, I've got to go pick you up, John. And I kept on that day, hey, John. So no, I'll go pick you up. Yeah. And he's like, no, you know. Anyway, I had my infusion, I then, which was in Prue, Orpington. Then I had to drive all the way to Lewisham. And I drove, went to pick him up. I waited in the waiting room. I rang his sister about half an hour later and I said, something's not right.
He was in there a lot longer than you expected him to be.
Yeah, he was in there for a lot longer. Anyway, I said, I'll ring her when I get off the phone. This was with Cheryl. And then eventually John came walking out and he called me across. And just his face, I could see his face. And it's just like, what is wrong? And he said to me, it's not good. It's not good, babe. That's what he said. It's just not good. And I'm like, well, what is it? And then they said they might have motor neuron disease. And immediately I knew what. I had a friend who died of motor neuron disease. He lasted 3 years, tidied. So I knew what it was. So I said, right, okay, let's go and speak and see where we go from here. And, you know, the shock of it all and trying, doesn't take a day just to take everything in what's been going on or anything like that. John wept. I've never seen John cry the way he cried that day.
So you were fully aware of the implications of what you'd been told, John?
Yeah, because I had a mate who died of it in the brigade.
You both had experience.
Yeah.
I had two people in my life die of it pretty recently before that as well, not many years, you know, within a handful of years. So when they told me that, I knew what I was up against instantly. That's why I cried instantly and just thought, nah, this can't be happening to me, you know. But, yeah, of all the diseases, I never do anything in half stave, you know, as you know. So if I was going to get ill, it was going to be a big one. But this was the biggest of the big. It still doesn't lessen the blow, you know, even though you sort of try and laugh it off or try and just get on with it, you can't lessen the blow of that.
Mm.
No one can deal. I don't think anyone deals with a MND diagnosis, to be honest with you. I'd like to meet someone who can honestly say, yeah, no, I've dealt with it. It's not a drama. No way.
Well, we'll talk about that in a short while, but Arlene, you're going back to obviously this life-changing news that something you don't deal with in a day or two. So, but how were those first few days? Can you remember?
Well, they said he might have it, so it was in May, we were told.
But there was still hope there then.
You know, and by July, they confirmed that, yes, it is MND. So we had, what, 2-3 months just not knowing.
24th of May, they told me I might have it. 10th of July, I was diagnosed.
This is going to sound a really silly question. Was there a certain amount of relief once there was a positive? Because the not knowing is sometimes worse than knowing, isn't it? A lot of people have said that.
Yeah. I think with MND, you can't have a clear diagnosis because there's no way of telling you, yes, you've definitely got it. That is the other thing about it. They have to rule everything out first, and then they say, yes, it is MND. But then again, 6 months down the line, it could be something different.
Yes.
But there is no diagnosis. There is no diagnosis.
And that's interesting, isn't it? Yeah. It's just the elimination of everything.
It's a very... The complication of MND is not only is it a rare disease, there is no biomarker still being found in the body to pinpoint the disease. So that's what makes it extremely... even more rare, more difficult to deal with. Like, they can't diagnose you because they've got nothing to pinpoint you. So what they do is they rule out everything they can test you for, then they give you an umbrella term of you must have motor neurone disease. You're just labelled with it, that's it. I could have a completely different disease going on to everyone else with it.
And that's important, isn't it? Maybe it's a good opportunity just to... perhaps if you could, John, just describe what motor neuron disease is and isn't.
Yeah, so what it is, it's a neurological disease, similar to Parkinson's, MS, dementia, Alzheimer's. They're all, they're all umbrella neurological diseases. But MND it manifests itself in a lot of different ways. It's a lot more of a heinous disease. It's the most life-shortening of the neurological diseases. It's the one they probably know the least about and the least help out there. Well, there basically isn't any help for you. There's one drug license in the UK, Reluzo, which does absolutely nothing for you. But the problem with MND is it doesn't take your brain with you. So unlike dementia and Alzheimer's, where you end up just losing you just end up losing your life, don't you? You don't even know who's sitting next to you. With MND, I'm going to be completely copper cementless. I'm going to become entombed in my body. So my brain is not going to be affected, and I'm just going to, my whole body. So my muscular system, it's called motor neuron disease because you've got different, you've got sympathetic nervous system, you've got sensory nervous system, and you've got a motor nervous system. Sensory nervous system, obviously, if I pinch you or punch you, it hurts. Motor nervous system is what the nerves that drive the muscles, the motor system. So with MND, and they don't know why, my motor system is closing down. Yeah, they know that it's a build-up of proteins which are misfolding in the motor neurons. I won't go into too much scientific because that's not really the name of, today. But basically, proteins are clumping up in my motor neurons, and they're stopping them eventually from sending the signal out. So the motor neurons can't send the energy from the spinal neurons, the lower motor neurons, in my specific case, to the muscles. And as a result, those bits of string attached to every muscle from the spine, they shorten. When energy is not being sent down, them ATPs and mitochondria, they shorten. And when they detach from the muscle, that's when the muscle atrophies and wastes away. So... and as a result, then you waste away. You can't move. Your body becomes completely incapacitated, and I'm going to end up entombed in my body. And obviously, the diaphragm and the breathing muscles will go the same way, and then you just stop breathing and you die.
Mm.
It's an awful. Well, they class it as the worst diagnosis in the world.
Essentially, you can't move your limbs, but yeah, no. you feel every sensation.
Yeah, I can still feel everything: hot, cold, pain. You still got your emotions, you still got your brain, still got active, but I'm going to be completely incapacitated. I'm not going to be able to talk, move, do anything at all. But I'll still be sitting there going, oh, hello, mate, if you walk in the room. Or, oh, I love you, Arlene, or I love your boys, you're my boys. But I'm just not going to be able to communicate with them other than blinking. It's an awful, awful disease. Awful.
A lot of people would deal with that news in any number of ways, I suppose, and a range of emotions from feeling sad, angry, why me, and how did it manifest itself with you, your emotions?
Well, upset, and I don't think there's anyone who gets diagnosed with MND doesn't go through the upset stage. It's impossible unless you've got nothing to live for, which is, let's be honest, there's not many people in the world that can say they haven't got anything to live for. It's upset. That's the main thing. It's just absolute heartbreak. Heartbreak for the people around you. I don't want to die, obviously, but I am. And we can go into that about we're all dying. We can all say that, can't we? But it's just upset, mate. It's upset and frustration as your body starts closing down. Frustration because you can't do even the simple things you've always been able to do all your life. So, yeah, it's difficult. It is difficult.
Mm.
Really difficult.
And how about you, Arlene? It must have been a whirlwind of emotions for yourself.
It is. I describe it more as a roller coaster because you don't know how you're going to be from one day to the next. You don't know what to expect or anything like that. So for me, the best way to describe it is a roller coaster, to be honest.
And that's very similar to grief, isn't it?
Yeah.
Comes in waves.
Yeah.
Mm.
Big time.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, when we're out and about, we put on this, you know, we okay and everything. But inside, we're both crumbling, I think, inside. Because it's a fight just to get out the door, to go out, you know, as getting yourself ready and hard work.
Mm.
It's hard work and it's not easy.
And I'm just wondering, but the question to both of you, do you feel that you have to be strong for each other? So I don't want to show my, you know, John, I don't want to show my emotions because it might upset Arlene. And Arlene, do you think the same thing? No, I've got to be strong for John because I don't want him getting upset.
I don't know. I don't show my emotions very good. You know, I hide mine. You know, this the duck, you see the little swan.
Yeah, yeah, the legs are going.
That's the way I describe myself.
Uh-huh.
You know, at the outside, I'm fine. I'm, you know, but inside, I don't show it.
Yeah.
I support John as much as I can. You know, we will have our arguments like everybody else. But that's the way we support each other. We'll have our banter to each other, but that's just the way we support each other. And I think that's the way we deal with it.
Hmm.
You know?
Well, it's interesting because you've got the sort of the everyday pressures of being a couple that any couple would have, but then you've got this added frustration and pressure of the diagnosis that you've had. And I'm just curious as to whether that does place a strain on your relationship.
No, it's not too much like that. If you know, if you love each other, I suppose you love each other, don't you? The strain is physically on Arlene. You know, she's having to do two lots of everything. She's having to help me more now because obviously I'm most of the time now I have to use the wheelchair if we're walking about because in the last 6 months my legs have just started giving up the ghost. You just got to get on with it. You got to, you know, it doesn't matter if I'm on the floor, I've got no arms and no legs. I could have been a quad all my life. You just got to get on with your life, haven't you? Yeah. Whatever's thrown at you, you've got to do the best you can. Use the equipment that can be helpful to you and the people that can be helpful to you. But you've got to get on with your life.
Now, like I say, you know, you've been living with this condition now for coming on 8 years.
Yeah.
But it's only been fairly recent, hasn't it, that the condition has worsened, if you will.
Yeah.
What effect has that had on your body?
Yeah, up until the beginning of the year, it was just my arms. So I had what they call flail arm. So I was hopeful, but you know, I was quietly hopeful that it would just stay in the arms. But clearly it hasn't. And it's been working its little merry way through my spine, you know, without a seeing. And now, obviously, it's my legs, my back, my neck. But to be fair, a bit of everything. A bit of everything's going now. But you know, that's how it is. It's a progressive disease. It was going to happen at some point, but it's happened now. You know, so I'm just trying my best to stay positive, which gets harder as well. The mental side of it gets harder. The physical side's the hardest bit to begin with. But then when a lot of physical starts breaking down, it starts getting a lot more mentally harder because I'm able to do less and less. But I'm, you know, you keep going, you keep going. I'm starting a new protocol with a guy in America who's reversing his MND. He's actually improving. So, and I do believe in a lot of what he's doing, having done a lot of studying myself. So I'm going to start that. I've got to have another attempt at it, Dave. You know, I've got to throw everything at the,
absolutely,
you know, at the beast, don't I? And see if I can stop it. So this is my next lot now that I'm going to start going through.
Arlene, obviously a life-changing diagnosis. But as John conditioned, has worsened physically, how has that changed your life on a day-to-day basis? Because obviously you care a lot for John.
Yes. So I work from home now. I have to have occupational health assessment and everything. And work's agreed I can work from home unless someone is in to look after John or can be there for John. But like I said, I do everything twice. You know, if I get myself dressed, I get John dressed, give John a shower, give myself a shower. You know, he eats, I eat. So everything I do, I have to do twice. So
yes. It's
tiring. It's challenging.
You're basically fitting 48 hours into 24 is what you're saying, isn't it?
This is it. So, yes. I mean, if someone says, oh, can you be there for 9 o'clock? It's just like, we'll be there for 9 o'clock. But it means I have to get up earlier just to get ourselves ready and get ourselves out the door.
Yes.
Because, I mean, John tries to be as independent as possible as he can, but he can't anymore.
No.
You know, so it's a juggling act.
Has that been hard to accept, John? Because knowing what you like, I would think it probably is.
Yeah, yeah, it is diverse. Well, it's proper frustrating, mate. It's you know, I've gone from being able to do everything. There's nothing that could faze me in my life, you know, physically or whatever, or mentally for that matter. But now, well, I can't. Can I? I can't do anything for myself. I can't brush my teeth. I can't open my front. I can't get in or out of my house. I can't get dressed. I can't do anything. Can't go to the toilet. So it's mega frustrating, you know, especially now with the legs going as well. Just walking, you know, is becoming extremely difficult. You know, hence the reason we use the wheelchair now more often than not. It's beyond frustrating, mate, to be honest with you. Beyond it.
A difficult question for you both, but obviously it is a terminal condition.
Mm.
Have you talked about that time when John may die or will die?
We have and we haven't.
Yeah, we, I mean, it's just, you know, it's just the comments about, oh yeah, I'll have that song in my funeral, you know, that sort of thing. I'll be honest, I think more about it now. I don't talk more about it, but I think more about it now. I keep thinking about my funeral a lot. I'm thinking, right, who would I want to be pallbearers? Who would I want, you know, what music and all that? I think about that a lot now because I know my own body and I know I'm nearer to that stage, you know. But you can't help it. Again, you can't help it. You cannot help it. It is what it is. You know, you just got to deal with it. And maybe that's, again, that mentally, that's how I'm dealing with it, I suppose.
Well, obviously, as John's death draws nearer, and nobody knows when that may be.
Yeah.
It could be next week. It could be in 10 years' time.
Mm.
Just how have you prepared for that moment?
You don't really prepare for it. I mean, I know it's going to come. You don't prepare for it at all. You can't prepare for it, I don't think, you know. We know it's going to come. So in the meantime, we're just doing everything that we can do. I think that is the way I'm dealing with it at the moment.
Yeah.
Just, I mean, we've had a close friend of ours die recently. And I can't talk about John, you know, he's going to die next week or he might die in a couple of hours. I'm not ready for that yet.
No.
Because we're still dealing with a friend of ours who's passed away and the shock of that and everything. So with John's death, it is in the back of my head, but it's not something we talk about as such. The two of us, you know, when that day comes, what we're going to do or
you think
things
it will
like
be
that.
A point and it goes down to your personality and the type of people you are. Do you think at some point that you might sit down together and have that really frank conversation? Because it'll be difficult.
It will be. We will put pen to paper at some point, but
it's difficult. You don't want to talk about it. You know, I think about it. I think about it every day since I got diagnosed. I wouldn't have thought there was a day where I don't think about it, but you try not to talk about it. Thinking about it and talking about it are two things. It's weird. When you talk about it, it's almost more real, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Thinking about it's real enough because I'm in the situation, but talking about it, then it becomes a different level. And suddenly you're thinking, blimey, we're even talking about it now. So, you know,
yes.
I just think, you know, we think about a lot of things in our heads, don't we? What we never really talk about with our halves, our mates, whoever. But talking about it's different. I think if I talk too much about it, it's too real then. You know,
yeah, maybe. And I suppose you want to concentrate on the here now. And now, the living.
Yeah,
you don't want to waste your time living talking about your death,
about dying. Yeah, I mean, you know, long time dead, isn't it? You know, we're only on this planet a short time. I suppose I don't want to talk about it because I just think that's my way of staying positive as well. Just talk about the things we've got coming up, the things we're going to do. But again, I've changed mentally there because I don't talk so much about those now. I'll say to Arlene, she'll say, oh, look, we're going to do that next year or whatever. And I'll say, well, I'm not going to be here for that, am I? I won't be around for that. So clearly things have changed, even with me mentally.
Yes.
Without realising it. I don't know when the switch was flicked, but I'm definitely talking differently as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Certainly, you know, in my previous career as a police officer, I dealt with a lot of families that had bereavement for all sorts of reasons. But a common theme that came through, a lot of them said, like, they regretted things. They regret they hadn't said certain things or they regretted they hadn't done certain things. You're living without regret. You've done everything that you need to do and say everything that you need to say.
I think we've done quite a fair bit of things. I mean, when John was diagnosed, our aim was to raise awareness of MND. And for the last 4 years...
Four years.
3 years. 2020 was the first one we did, isn't it? The cycle. we've been raising awareness. I mean, we cycled John O'Groats to Land's End. He skydived over Everest and then trekked this year up to Everest. We've had different challenges in between COVID and things like that.
Oh, yeah, we've done a lot.
When we look back, it's like we've done a lot. I took 3 months off work because I came home one day and I said to John, I'm not going to wait for you to be on your deathbed before I stop working. The last year, I took 3 months off and we were on the road nearly every day.
Mm.
Went up to Scotland. We managed to meet Doddy Weir, you know, met other MND sufferers. We went to Nepal, trekked up to Nepal.
South Africa.
We went to South Africa. So we're trying to do anything and everything, really.
And I think you described it, you know, you've got this, I don't know, is it a charity or is it just a...
just an awareness campaign,
It's a campaign to raise awareness for motor neuron disease. But I think you've described it as making memories, haven't you?
Yeah. The thing is, though, you know, too many people in this world are selfish. Every one of us is selfish at times. It might only be a small thing. It might be you pick up the last toilet roll on the shelf when people panic buy, you know, whatever. But what I'm saying is every one of us is selfish at times. Doesn't matter how large that selfish behaviour is, you know, or how significant it is to others, we're selfish. And I have been. But since I've been diagnosed, we've done nothing but spend a load of our money. We're not wealthy, but we have spent thousands, if not tens of thousands, of our own money raising awareness for MND. We've raised a certain amount of money. Even though we're not a charity, we've raised a fair few quid for research, because I won't donate to charities because I just think they're all corrupt charities. Well, they're not even charities, they're just companies. So I'm not donating to people's salaries. I'm donating to research. I want to find a cure, because it might be too late for me, as I say, but it's not too late for my kids or their kids. But if we do nothing about it, everyone's going to die. Fact. Every one of us is going to die. So we've done a massive amount of raising research. I'd say we've done more than a lot of people with, you know, celebrity status, for want of a better way of putting it.
Mm.
So I'm more than happy that I've made up for my selfish times in my life. My legacy would be, well, look what the boy did. Jesus, you know, give him a break. Look what he did. You know, it's incredible what he did.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not doing it for effect. It's not about effect. It's about raising awareness.
And you mentioned your children, because you do have kids.
Yeah.
There must be a tough time for them.
Yeah, it is very tough, actually. Yeah, it's very tough because they're all different. You know, my daughter died, sadly, years ago. So she's not around to go through this, which is a great thing, really. But yeah, my boys are my little heroes. You know, they're all different in a different way. Chris, my eldest, he's like my best mate.
Mm.
Absolute champion. Everything he does, he's a champion. Ollie and Jake struggle to even talk about it. In fact, they won't talk about it with me. You know, me and Chris talk openly about it, even though I can see it pains him talking about it, but we talk about it. Ollie and Jake are different. They won't talk about it because they get too upset. And then Lucas is only 7. And he actually does talk about it with me, albeit the little bit he knows. And it's hard. It's hard. In fact, it's heartbreaking. You know, as much as they pick my day up and I feel great being around them, they put a smile on my face, it's heartbreaking because soon they're gonna have no dad. And they don't get another one. So, you know, it's all going to be based on memories then. And that hurts me. It hurts me more for them than for me.
Mm.
Because I know what they're going to go through and they're going to be heartbroken. I am anyway. I'm living heartbreak every day. They're going to live it. Once I go, they're going to live it. And, you know, I've had to sit there and have to chat with them about it, and it's not nice. It's not nice.
No, I mean, I should imagine it's probably the hardest, apart from telling Arlene, perhaps, it's probably the hardest thing you've ever had to do in your life.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, without a doubt. Without a doubt. Yeah, yeah, it's tough. And you know, it's tough for them because they've got to deal with it.
Yeah.
I think they're young. They're still young. They're kids still, you know, so it's hard for them. I mean, Lucas, bless him, he's only 7. And he tries to be, you know, I'll hold your hand, Dad. Your dad, your hand will get better, you know. So, yeah, it is hard for them.
Yeah, it's getting harder. You know, only a friend of mine, funny enough, a sort of part of family in effect, so my boy's uncle, the other side of their family, has just only died of MND 4 months ago. You know, John Cook, lovely bloke, got diagnosed, was dead in a year. You know, and he was a top bloke, John. So they've had to deal with that. They went to his funeral and it was really upsetting for them because, you know, like Chris said to me, well, yeah, it was horrible, Dad, because we know what's coming.
Yeah.
So it's really horrible. That really hit home to them.
I think, you know, death is a part of life. It's inescapable. And we all remember, don't we, whether we were young adults or perhaps children ourselves, that first bereavement that you have either of a mum or a dad or a brother or somebody close to you. You never forget that, do you?
No.
And I think it's important that obviously your kids, some of them are going to be older than the others when you do finally die. But as long as they've got happy memories, I think that makes such a difference to dealing with bereavement.
Yeah. I think it's all about the memories, isn't it? And your legacy that you leave. You know, I like to think that when I go, they've got to get on with their lives. Arlene, the boys, they've all got to get on with their lives. You know, I'm just a part of their lives at the minute. And when that part of their lives go, they've got to move on. I said, well, Arlene, you've got to move on with your life. You've got to enjoy your life still. Just because I'm dead, it doesn't mean you can't enjoy your life. And same with my boys. But, you know, as long as I've left the best legacy I can, then when I'm gone, at least they'll look back at photos and the events we've done, the awareness you raise, and they'll have a laugh about it and go, oh, do you remember when we done that? You know, hopefully they'll all raise a bit more awareness still on this awful disease, because as a community, MND, we all need to be doing our bit. Because six people every day are diagnosed with this, and six people every day are dying from it, just in this country alone. It's a shocking disease. We all need to be doing our bit.
And I suppose the best epitaph for you is your kids, isn't it?
Of course it is. Yeah, of course it is. You know, and hopefully my boys can stand in front of someone in years to come and say, well, you know, this was my dad, look what he did, you know, and I'm carrying it on or whatever. You know, just keep that going. We've got to keep going until we find a cure now. We have to.
Well, you mentioned your campaign.
Yeah.
And obviously raising awareness, which you certainly are, raising money, which you certainly have been and still doing. There must have been some funny moments over that journey that, we have to ask you to keep it clean, John, now.
In fact,
it might be nigh impossible with you.
I mean, since I've been diagnosed, I've had loads of good moments. You know, we've done some brilliant things. We've done some ridiculous things, you know, a lot of it based around getting drunk and having a laugh, you know what I mean? Because you still got to have a laugh, albeit it's not good for me physically with MND. Loads of moments, mate, you know, when we've met the Duchess and, you know, she's had a good swear with me on the phone, and she, the Duchess at times, Sarah Ferguson, she's a big backer of us, and she's an amazing person, to be fair. Just everyone I meet, Dave, really. You know, all the celebs that have helped us along the way, we've sort of like literally dragged ourselves onto their doormats until they say yes, you know, that sort of thing.
Yes.
Doddy, we literally gatecrashed his house, didn't we?
John's very clever, shall I say. So we were in Scotland and John said, I'm going to go and find Doddy's house. And Brian White, a good friend of ours, which we'll see next week, he said, oh, if I had the courage, I would ask if I can come along. And we said, yes, you can come along, you know, not a problem. Anyway, we found Doddy Weir's house and John sat in the car and he goes, right, you go knock on the door. And it's like, ah, thanks, John. So we turned up there, we knocked on the door, and Gene came to the door, which was his PA at the time, and I just said, oh, we've come unannounced, and everything, explained everything. And she said, right, okay, I'll go.
But they didn't even know of you.
No.
It was just complete.
It was total, you know, total strangers knocking on somebody's front door, basically. Anyway, she came back. I explained, John's got MND, we raise awareness, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, she came back and she says, you've got 5 minutes. We ended up staying over an hour.
Wow. Mm. Did he get a word in edgeways with you, John?
Yeah, well, funny, he did, didn't he? Funny enough. I mean, his voice was going and he was quite difficult to understand, to be fair. He was a lot more physically incapable than I thought. I was quite shocked, actually, to be fair, though, when we saw him. It's quite sad. And Brian, bless him, you know, ex-paratrooper, ex-sergeant in the power, as hard as nails, actually started crying because Doddy was a hero of his. And then when we had finished talking, you know, Doddy was fascinated by me talking to him. Oh, you've got to send me details of that, you know, supplements and things to try. And then Brian wanted a picture with him, said, Doddy, would it be okay? And Doddy went, yeah, of course it is. You know, that'd be my pleasure. And Brian started crying. And I got up and I started welling up and said, oh, Brian, you know, don't you're going to get me in tears now? You know, and Brian just said, Doddy, this is an amazing occasion, one of the big days of my life meeting you. You're a hero of mine.
Yes.
And, you know, it's really upsetting, wasn't it?
Mm.
Really upsetting, actually. And then, obviously, 6 months later, Doddy died.
Mm.
You know, sadly, we was at Twickenham when the news broke that he'd sadly passed away, which made me cry. I was at Twickenham there watching England and South Africa, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Mm. I think he's in South Africa. And I just cried. You know, we're looking up. And I think someone in the crowd at Twickenham looked around and saw me crying, didn't they? And said, oh, yeah. Right, mate. And I think the group we was with went, no, look, that was a mate of his, you know, Doddy Weir. Blah, blah, blah. It's quite upsetting, actually. It's quite upsetting. You know, we've met a lot of people with MND along the way, haven't we? And
yeah.
It's always upsetting, isn't it? It's always upsetting when someone's body's closing.
I was going to say, you've kind of been immersed in a world now where you are talking with fellow MND sufferers.
Which I didn't want to do.
You are one of the few that have lived a good life after your diagnosis, and you watching all these people around you, that must have an effect on you.
Oh, it's horrible, Dave. It's horrible. And again, it's frightening because I know I'm getting that way now. I'm more down the line now. And it is frightening. I mean, we had Roy Taylor and who else died that week? Lee Taylor and Roy Taylor, funny enough.
Yeah.
Not related. They both died within, what, 2-3 weeks of each other? Both friends of ours, you know, but certainly with Lee, that was a bit unexpected.
Mm.
You know, he was further down the line than I was on that, but we get the message, oh, Lee's died last night in hospital. Was he in hospital? I can't remember. No, he might have been home, but it's shocking and it's upsetting. And I sit there quite empty for the day, you know what I mean, thinking, Christ. And more and more people are dying around us of this awful disease.
Well, you continue with your campaign, John versus MND. I think you're on all the social media platforms, aren't you? What are your plans, current and future plans, with that at the moment?
What have you got lined up?
Well, I'm trying to push out to do one of John's bucket lists. It's trying because 80%, John, correct me on this, 80%. Of MND sufferers will lose their voice.
They'll lose their ability to talk, breathe, eat. It'll be on ventilators, etc. So what we're trying to do, we've got this guy called Lloyd Wade, and he's incredible. He's an incredible singer, and he's worked with some of the biggest stars. And through someone else, we've managed to get in touch with one of the big music producers who used to do producing for Elton John and Ed Sheeran and all that. Will Hicks, his name is. And it looks like we're in the process of getting his studio. And it looks like he's going to help us make this a reality.
We're going to have a conversation with him on Monday and see whether we can make this a reality.
Mm.
And see where we can go with it. You know, it might be something, it might be a nothing. But I just feel this is something we should push for now.
Yes.
In one way or another, if he can't help us, we'll try somehow to do it ourselves. You know, just to me, it's just like I want to do it for John and for the MND sufferers out there, because I think it will be massive, you know, just to get that bit of awareness out there to say this is out there.
Yeah.
You know, we need someone just to see it.
If people can see a video of MND sufferers trying their hardest to sing a song and struggling, some not, hopefully some have still got a great voice and all that, I think that would hit a nerve with most people, like the Military Wives Choir did, like a lot of things do. That will hit a nerve with people. And if we can certainly get the backing of someone who's in the right place, like this Will Hicks, who can push that out to people, you know, who knows, it could become, I know it sounds silly, but you've got to punch for the stars. You've got to reach for the stars.
Mm.
It could become a charity single. It could raise money for research. Who knows? But all we need, all I've kept trying to do, Dave, is just hit the nerve of a philanthropist, someone in the right place at the right time who goes, blimey, let's pick up on this. This is incredible. Look what this young lad's doing.
Yeah.
You know, and that's all I'm trying to do. You know, it's all I'm trying to do without being having a sports star celebrity status, which we haven't got. And I think, you know, pound for a punch, and I think a lot of great people agree with us, we've done more for MND awareness than most people, even people that have got backing.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think anyone's done what we've done, tried how we've tried. No way.
So finally then, for question to both of you, is motor neuron disease, what needs to happen?
So motor neuron disease, we all need to know what it is. Everyone should know what it is. It's more rife than you believe. We all need to know the devastation, what it causes families, the devastating disease that it is, signs and symptoms we need to know about, and we need to push for research. We need to push for a cure, because every single person that's diagnosed with MND is dead man or woman walking. Simple as that. There's not a thing out there. Big Pharma need to kick up the backside. Yeah, I know they've got to make profit for their shareholders, which sadly we're just another algorithm in the business of pharmaceutical giants. Unfortunately, we're not a big enough cog. There's not enough of us with this disease for them to actually, for their ears to prick up and them to sit up and go, hang on, we'll smash this one because this will make us a fortune. There's not enough of us with it.
That's interesting, isn't it? When you think about, I think of AIDS in the late 80s. And the amount of research that has gone into AIDS and HIV, which turned a fatal condition into a perfectly survivable one.
Perfectly livable condition now, isn't it? People don't die of AIDS now, do they? Not well, generally speaking, people don't die of AIDS. There still might be the odd person, obviously undiagnosed, I don't know. But we need to bring that into with MND. You know, we just need to find a cure.
Well, it's a somber note to finish on, but John and Arlene, thank you very much indeed.
Yeah, our thank pleasure, you. Mate. Our pleasure. Good to see you, Dave. Good to see you, mate.
DCT Audio, the art of good listening.